So if you've stopped by my office any point in the last few weeks, or even looked through the windows, you might have noticed my small collection of icons that are now mounted on the wall behind my desk, and perhaps not coincidentally over my little coffee maker. I'm not terribly well informed about icons. Perhaps some of you here know far more than I do. And I don't actually use them very often in a deliberate way in my own prayer life, but I do like them. They're quite beautiful. And I like the sense of history that they bring with them. But more importantly, I like the way their presence draws my attention, if only for a moment, to consider the nature and working of God. This is fundamentally the purpose of icons, after all. And it's more fully expressed when you actively use them as part of contemplative prayer, but it is fulfilled even in passing, which is why many Orthodox Christian homes will have icons displayed near the doorway, so that as you come in the home, you are reminded of the nature and working of God. Because icons are not simply art. They are not ends in and of themselves. They are but means. They are intended to point beyond themselves. They've been described as windows designed to be looked through, not at. They have also, of course, been described as signs, directing our gaze to what we actually need to see. And this is an important feature of signs. Think of a road sign. If the road sign so captures your attention that you just look at it instead of looking at what it is telling you to look at, you will have a problem. Other things serve as icons in this way too. The whole of our worship, the words we speak, the music that we make, the images and colors we surround ourselves with, all of this is not intended to capture our attention itself, but to direct our attention onward to God. And icons needn't be limited to explicitly religious stuff either. The whole world directs our attention to its maker. But icons do have a sort of complicated history within Christianity. At various times and places, icons, along with other sacred images, were condemned as idolatrous. Their critics feared that the icons were not serving as signs and had instead become the object of worship, that they were, in fact, the end and not simply the means. And while I don't think there is any actual evidence of people worshiping the kinds of icons I have on my wall, there is plenty of evidence that people are often and easily confused about where to direct their devotion. Without us even realizing it, gifts from God can become little gods in and of themselves. And we can find ourselves, for all intents and purposes, worshiping not God, but our family, or our health, or a particular kind of spiritual experience, or our own success and security. We can end up just staring at the sign instead of allowing it to direct our gaze where it needs to go. Moses, of course, knew this intimately. He knew just how distractible the human heart can be, having spent years in the desert with the Israelites, who were often distracted. And in today's reading from the book of Deuteronomy, Moses is wrapping up a lesson on the importance of knowing where you come from and to whom you belong. Because even when they wandered in the desert, forced to rely on nothing but God's miraculous faithfulness to sustain them. His people could forget that. We can forget that. So how much harder would it be when they were finally comfortable and prosperous, free from worry and want? Moses knew that instead of seeing the fruits of the land as signs which point to God and to God's generosity, the people might settle for the fruits of the land as the ultimate goal and end up worshiping their own comfort or their own labor or even their own land. And so Moses gave them a religious ritual, words and actions to recall them to the truth. Every year, they are to take the first fruits of harvest to the priest, and they are to recite a sort of confession of faith as they make their offering. This is the confession of faith that they are told to recite. A wandering Aramean was my ancestor. That's Abraham, just a note. He went down into Egypt and lived there as an alien, few in number, and there he became a great nation, mighty and populous. When the Egyptians treated us harshly and afflicted us by imposing hard labor on us, we cried to the Lord, the God of our ancestors. The Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. The Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with a terrifying display of power and with signs and wonders. And he brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. So now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground that you, O Lord, have given me. But this is not the end of the religious ritual that Moses has given them. After they have made their offering and recited their faith, they are to celebrate God's faithfulness with the bounty of the earth, and they are to include in their celebration all those with no land of their own. The Levites, who was the priestly tribe who had not been given land, but instead given a job, and the aliens in their midst, people who were not Israelite but lived in the communities, were to be included in the celebration. Moses is calling his people to a full practice of thanksgiving, which includes recognizing what you have, remembering that it points to God and to God's steadfast loving kindness, which is as present with us in hard times as in easy ones, and then responding to God's generosity with joy and generosity of your own so that no one is left out. It is a practice of thanksgiving that emphasizes the giver rather than the gift, a distinction that continues to be challenging to hold on to. I don't know about you, but in my experience, it can be easy to become focused on the feast, the food that will be eaten, the table that will be set, the company that will be gathered, and to forget, or at least neglect, the source from which it all comes. Such forgetfulness risks making our thankfulness selfish and self-serving, a celebration of our own comfort and prosperity rather than a celebration of and participation in God's faithfulness. Such forgetfulness turns the feast into an idol rather than an icon. And such forgetfulness does not serve us well in seasons of hardship because idols are false gods. There are people this weekend, and some of you might well be among them, who are not celebrating Thanksgiving as a holiday. People who will not have a feast because they do not have the food, because they do not have the people, because they do not have the health. People whose lives have been disrupted by tragedy, both local, like the families of the men who were shot in our own community last week, and global, like the families of people living in places of war or of exile. People for whom Thanksgiving relies not on obvious good things, but on being able to see beyond the surface layer of their lives and recognize that God is still with them, sustaining them and guiding them and loving them and calling the world around them to justice and compassion. Thanksgiving is not always easy. Indeed, it may never be easy, either because we don't feel we have much to be thankful for, or because we have come to take all that we do have for granted. But Thanksgiving is always life-giving, calling our attention beyond our circumstances, whatever they may be, and directing our gaze to God. And so this weekend, may you see through Thanksgiving as through a window that opens onto God. And seeing God, may you make of your life an offering in love and service to God and the world God loves.